Okay, hey guys, and welcome to the Three Drinks In podcast, episode number 210. I'm your host, Vince. Over there is your host, Phil.
Hey.
There he is. In this episode, we are talking about the new movie Nobody, starring Bob Odenkirk and the guy that ate Michael Ironside. Before we get into that, though, I want to remind you that Three Drinks In is available on all streaming services, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and iHeartRadio. Make sure that you subscribe, tell your friends, and leave a review. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Three Drinks In Pod. You can head to our website and check out the merch store over at TeePublic. You can like us on Facebook, and you can email us at threedrinksinpodcast@gmail.com. So I got your text, late last night or this morning, like, oh my God, what happened to Michael Ironside?
Oh my God.
And that was huge. Like, I literally have that note, and I was just, you know, just like that's Michael Ironside? Because I saw him, and all I could think, like, the last thing I saw him in besides this was, I think, X-Men First Class.
Oh, yeah, well.
Where he was, I mean, like, he's kind of a ridiculous, over-the-top kind of an actor, but it doesn't help that that they shot him in that film the way that they did. Like, all you see is a pair of binoculars, and then they slowly lower, and it's the steel chiseled mug of iron of Michael Ironside staring at, like, dead into the camera. It's like he was in a different movie than the rest of them for a minute, you know.
Yeah, it was. I couldn't get over how big he is now. I mean, he's huge.
He was, yeah. I mean, just completely just a big guy. And I mean, he was relatively thin, you know, his whole career. He played a lot of, like, you know, army guys, and, you know, he's just always very serious. And but yeah,
he was always army guys. So
I hope he's okay.
Or something. I think
he didn't look particularly healthy, but he's not a young. He's not a young man. You know, I can look up how old he actually is, but I was very surprised.
He's 71.
Okay, well, you know, at 71, who's gonna bust his chops about it?
Yeah,
let him have the extra ice cream. Who cares?
You know, and like when I picture him, he was Darkseid in the Superman animated series. You know, so like I always picture him still doing this like really dramatic, deep, slow voice. And you know what? Who I heard today? I was watching Justice League with my son. And there was some side character who was in it. And I'm like, wow, that voice is really odd. I wonder whose voice that is. It was the guy who played Bob the Goon. He was playing some bit part in Justice League. And I was like, good for him. He still was working.
He was an odd character in that. Bob Gunn.
Hey, he had his own action figure.
He did. Speaking of Michael Ironside, though, so when Christopher Lloyd shows up in this movie, I had read somewhere, it might have been one of those Looper YouTube videos where it's just like, the truth is why this guy is never in movies anymore and this kind of thing. And one of them was like, you know, why you don't see Christopher Lloyd in films anymore. It's like, actually, you see him in movies and TV all the time because he has 239 credits on IMDb, which is amazing. He's one of those actors that just works constantly, just never really stops. And he's just, whatever he does, I mean, like, whatever there is, he'll do it. Like, he did an NCIS recently, for crying out loud. Like, he was in The West Wing. He's in Kingdom Hearts. He just works constantly. And Michael Ironside is kind of the same way. That, like, he's got even more. He's got 272 credits. But he's done a lot of B movies. And so, like, when you're in those films, they take about a week to shoot the whole movie. And, like, you know, you can rack up credits in IMDb really, really easily. But you know, we all have this image of Christopher Lloyd as being kind of larger than life because he played, you know, really important roles in, you know, pretty big pop culture moments. It was, you know, Back to the Future, Roger Rabbit, Adam's Family. But, you know, he's just as much of a working actor as Michael Ironside is. He was a lot less famous than Christopher Lloyd.
Yeah, a lot less. You know, good for him.
Yeah, so... So Nobody, starring Bob Odenkirk in his first action role. Yeah, so do you want to give like a quick recap of the plot? Without too many spoilers, I guess. I don't know if we get into that.
I mean, well, we can spoil it.
Yeah.
I mean, well, I guess we'll have to. It's about him. He's a middle-class suburbanite kind of guy. And he gets... His family gets robbed in like a home invasion and he doesn't do anything about it. He plays like this schlubby sad sack character. And then you find out halfway through that he actually was in like a secret assassin for the government. And he takes his anger out on a bunch of street toughs on a bus. And one of them is a Russian gangster whose brother comes for revenge. And he has to end up fighting like the Russian mob, very similar to John Wick. And that's the whole movie.
Yeah, my my friend Mike's actually been listening to the podcast. I was like, "Oh, you're the one. Good for you."
Yeah, that's two now.
There you go. And so I think the first one he played was the was it Godzilla? Yeah, Godzilla versus Kong. And then he listened to the last one with okay, what the hell was that last movie we did? It seems like ages ago. Yeah, Mortal Kombat. And he's like, so do. Do you guys like anything? And all I can think of is your friend Mo, who is like, does Phil like hate everything on purpose or like? But
no, although I didn't like this.
Oh, but see, I like this movie.
I didn't like this movie.
This was a good movie. Come on,
it was not a good movie.
It was a good movie. Wasn't a great movie. John Wick is a better movie. This is basically John Wick Light. But as like entertainment fare, like this is a perfectly reasonable way for me to spend an hour and 40 minutes. Like it's, you know, I thought it was, you know, the plot was simple. It was a little too simple, but at the same time, it wasn't sort of overwrought. You know, like it wasn't, you know, they didn't explain too much. It wasn't written in a convoluted way. Most of the information in the story was, you know, transmitted in a relatively efficient fashion. You know, there wasn't too much that was extraneous. You know, there's not much story to it. So they didn't have the guys talk a lot and explain very much. And, you know, I think like my biggest criticism for it is like the simplicity of it. Like it's just sort of a, you know, like a sad sack guy who, you know, doesn't seem to, you know, there isn't much to him, and then you find out that there is, and you don't really need to know all of it, but you get little bits and pieces that kind of fill in the gaps as to why someone with his skill set could find themselves in such a banal existence. And you know, and then it just kind of goes off the rail and it's ridiculous and over the top, and it's what John Wick is. And you know, the biggest difference I would say between the John Wick movies, and I've only ever seen, I think, two of them. I didn't see the third John Wick, and I meant to, just never got around to it, is that the world of John Wick is sort of better established. You know, that's the one thing that makes John Wick a more interesting film and makes the franchise more possible, is that they've established a set of rules for the universe of the John Wick story. This didn't have that. This was just a, you know, much more tightly focused. It's about this guy and these crazy Russians, and a lot of people get shot in the head, and it's just ridiculously over the top and silly. But you know, okay, so like it's not any more ridiculously over the top and silly than a lot of Marvel movies, where they got laser blasters and what have you. So I don't know. I thought it was a lot of fun, and Bob Odenkirk, you know, is good. He's a weird guy, I would think, you know, and he's you know, he got to start writing comedy. He did, you know, that sort of offbeat Kids in the Hall. Was he Kids in the Hall? Is that him? I'm trying to think.
I don't know.
I can't remember now, but that's sort of his thing as far as like sketch comedy goes. It's not Chris Farley. It's not Will Ferrell. It's sort of offbeat weirdo humor.
Yeah, he was the other half of Mr. Show.
That's right, Mr. Show, which I never really was. Him and Dave, like the guy from.
Yeah, he was in Arrested Development.
Arrested Development. Yeah, yeah.
He's famous too.
Yeah. So like, just, you know, not quite strangers with candy weird, but just a little bit specific in terms of their sense of humor. And then he reinvents himself essentially with Better Call Saul, which was the straddling of those two worlds. He was the comic relief in a very serious drama and continued that in a drama that he got to run himself, but, you know, set in the same, like, you know, as the same character. That's kind of unusual in a way. And then to, you know, to turn that into like an action story is like, that's a pretty unique set of circumstances where like he's different in every situation, but, you know, he still retains his Bob Odenkirkness throughout. So yeah, I thought it was fun.
I thought this was a comedy when I first started watching it.
Oh.
And like everybody, even my wife was like, oh no, it's not. I'm like, what do you mean? No, it's not. You picked a comedian to do the exact same thing Keanu Reeves already did. I'm not saying it has to be the Naked Gun, but like, I thought it would be funny. You know, like I that's what I thought. And so once I realized that's not what it was, I was like, okay, fine. So I switched my expectations. And I think that it like ran out of movie halfway through. It paints itself into a corner. He gets robbed. There's, you know, he goes after the people who took his daughter's little bracelet because he was like, I don't care about a couple of bucks, but, you know, I don't want them to hurt my daughter. And he goes to get revenge and get the thing back. And like the two hoods that robbed him are like a poor man and woman with a baby on a ventilator. And I was like, oh, that's new. And even he makes that face like, well, now I can't take out my anger on them. So he gets on the bus and he's driving home and a bunch of, you know, gang members jump on the bus drunk and he takes his fury out on them. And he gets his butt kicked a little bit too. So, you know, it's like a realistic looking kind of thing.
Yeah, it was a good fight.
And then, you know, that's like the 40 minute mark. There's no more story. So all of a sudden the gangster brother shows up and like, I have to get revenge and sick my entire army of goons on this one person. I was like it veered from sort of interesting into ridiculous silliness. And I was like, this is dumb. Like this part makes no sense. Like the movie really lost me, and the fights and the gunplay weren't nearly as interesting after that bus scene that I was like interested enough.
Yeah, there's definitely like two halves of the movie. There's the first half where you're watching somebody go through a thing and struggle with their, you know, with their identity, and I mean, you actually find out like so like. I guess it's like the middle of the second half. So I guess that would be three quarters.
Three quarters. Fractions, how do they work?
When he has the guys tied up in the basement, he's like explaining to them kind of like who he is. And he, you know, took pity on one guy that he was sent to kill and goes to check up on the guy and finds that he's like become a normal person. He's not embezzling money like he was. He's not doing anything stupid. And, you know, he's living the dream of having the wife and the kids and the white picket fence and the dog and the car and the whole thing. And he's like, well, why couldn't that be me? And that's when he kind of, you know, hangs up his spurs and goes off on that. And, you know, there's flashes of that. That's the thing. It's that conflict within the character. Like, can I do this? I used to live an exciting and dangerous life, and then all of a sudden I traded that in because this looked better. And it turns out that I'm miserable now because I'm not actually getting anywhere, and my kid hates me, and my life is boring, and my wife, who is not an unfamous actress, but is, you know, not a terribly famous one, doesn't really do anything in this movie. She has almost no role. And so, yeah, like he all of a sudden, like you, that scene kind of makes it, kind of puts the first half of the film in perspective to say, like, I thought I was going to be, you know, retiring and finding, you know, the inner peace of suburban bliss. And it turns out that I was miserable. And, you know, things just boiled over. But you're right. Like, there is a shift in like the first, like I wrote down in my notes, like this bus fight is very, very realistic. That's the last realistic violence that appears in the movie. You know, there's after that, it's just all headshots and John Wick and nonsense.
Yeah, they go through his funhouse of explosions. And I'm like, this is really, it was like, you know, Home Alone with grenades. I'm like, this is so dumb.
Yeah.
You know, he put like the rebars in like cannons and he would fire them off and the guys would just stand there and get impaled with rebar. And I was like, this is so stupid.
Yeah. I mean, it does migrate to farce at about the halfway point of the movie.
I found that, yeah. So like this whole second half of the movie, I was like, I'm checked out. This is not for me. And I love gratuitous violence. I mean, sure. I enjoy clips of Mortal Kombat on YouTube. So it's not like I don't like that stuff. I think the problem was I couldn't get invested in the beginning half because it's not clear what the problem is. Right. So like they show you the montage of him failing at being a suburbanite, right? Like he forgets the garbage. His wife takes all the coffee. His kid doesn't talk to him. He has a dead end job. And so my brain thinks, okay, this guy is kind of pathetic and a loser and stuff like that. And then you realize there's something up with him when he gets robbed and he could get the drop on the two people, but he doesn't. And everyone makes fun of him like, oh, if that was my family, I would have beat the crap out of him. You know, and there's like little weird hints that he knows more than he's letting on. But there's also these image, like they show him in the montage of him doing like pull-ups on the bus stop. And the bus ad is his wife's face. He's like staring angrily at her. So I'm sitting here thinking like, is it his wife's fault that he's unhappy? Like, that's not clear either.
That part, yeah, I didn't understand the sit-ups thing or the pull-up thing, because like at first I was like, is that the woman he wants to be with and his wife is someone different? And like, no, that's just Connie Nielsen, that's the woman playing his wife,
right? Like that's his wife. And I'm like, oh, you know, and like it exactly what the issue is isn't exactly clear. He's just unhappy, and it doesn't really jive with the character of the proactive murderer. Especially when, like in John Wick, I mean, you can only compare it to that because the same guy wrote the screenplay. You know, in John Wick, everyone knew who he was, and his wife knew who he was, and he gave the life up and was happy with that. And it's not till later, like you said, like Bob Odenkirk is basically like, this is what I thought, and it's not what I ended up getting. But like, why not? Why? What's the issue here? How can you keep that from your family?
So there's two things I think that could answer that question. One is sort of, you know, within the movie, and one is sort of without of the movie or outside the movie. The first thing is that, you know, that the characters, that's who he is, and by trying to play Leave It to Beaver in any town USA, he's actually just kidding himself, and he really does belong in that kind of line of work, and which is sort of thin and, you know, obvious and a little bit boring. But there's another thing I think that's going on in this case, and it's that a lot of people who write movies, a lot of young people, a lot of you know, Hollywood types, for lack of a better phrase, generally assume that everybody doing what you and I are doing is secretly miserable. And this is not new. This has been going on for, you know, decades now. The looking at the bourgeoisie and just assuming that they're all lying to themselves. So the best example of this, the most overt example of this, is American Beauty, which I was not aware of this as a point of view, but Alan Ball, who wrote American Beauty, was, you know, a gay man and is, you know, was certainly active in you know, I don't say gay causes, but, like, you know, this was a significant point of view for a lot of people who were gay in the 1990s, you know, at the sort of the fished the kind of the tail end of the AIDS epidemic. And is that, like, they thought that, you know, the Leave It to Beaver thing was not only stupid, but dangerous. And that's why, like, the three families that you see living in that movie, you know, you have Lester Burnham and his family, and they're, you know, lying to themselves and angry and unhappy, but don't admit it. You have the gay couple, who are the only, you know, normal people, like, on the block. And then you have the murderous psychopath who's, you know, burying his sexuality and torturing his wife and son. And so this is just a common thing in Hollywood to assume that, you know, for the most part, people who live the way you and I live in the suburbs with our very normal cisgendered heteronormative lifestyles, we're essentially either kidding ourselves or it's so boring that it would drive someone out of their mind eventually. And I think that part of that perspective on this lifestyle makes people lazy when they write characters that exist in that world. Like, they didn't really have to try very hard to explain why he's miserable. The setting is supposed to do that for you. And if you're of that setting, then it's going to be less obvious. If you've chosen to live that way, it's less obvious to you that this is what they're trying to do necessarily.
Yeah, I guess. I just don't. His actions, the way the movie frames it, it's not clear. You know, because he's taking his lumps. And yet at the same time, it's like, I got to get my frustration and anger out somehow by, like, when he starts chasing down. Goes to tattoo parlors to chase down the people who robbed his house. You know, like, my first thought was, okay, we're going to get scenes of a guy who's in over his head. And how does a guy like that, you know, go through something? How is that going to change him? But at that point, you don't already know he's like some ultra assassin. Like, he's not the one you should be worried about getting killed or anything. It's everyone else that he comes into contact with. You know, like, the movie didn't set that up, because all you've seen for the first 20 minutes is him being a failure at everything. Well, so when he starts walking around town, I'm like, oh, is he going to get his ass kicked? I mean, is he not good at this? And then you find, like, oh, wait, people are afraid of him. And it doesn't help that he looks like Bob Odenkirk. He's not a scary looking person. So, like, the cognitive dissonance is shocking.
No, you see, I don't know if I agree with that. Like, I liked the fact that you sort of assumed, like, well, this, you know, here's, you know, Joe Lunchpail out to, you know, get revenge for his daughter and her kitty cat bracelet. And, you know, the first thought is he's in over his head. But the way in which they start to explain to you that he's not what he looks like, those were the kind of moments I liked. So he's in the tattoo parlor, and he's about to get his ass kicked, and he raises his arm up, and some guy sees his tattoo and freaks out, says thank you for your service, and locks himself behind like seven deadbolts in a steel door. And, like, that's good screenwriting. That's not saying, like, I know that tattoo, you're part of this group. Like, no one says anything, they just do something. There was a lot of showing and not telling in this screenplay, and I liked that about it. It wasn't, like, the scenes that required, you know, explanation were kind of short-lived. Like, he tries to explain to the dying Black Russian guy who he was, and, you know, they called me the auditor because I'm the last person that you ever want to see. And in the middle of trying to tell him that, the guy dies, and he can't finish his story.
I mean, there was no payoff to that stuff.
What do you mean?
You know, I mean, they give you those hints and drips and drabs, but you still don't really know what he is or how he got to be that way.
Do you need to know more than what he's doing, though? Like, he's, I mean, again, it's over the top, and maybe that's what makes it sort of hard for some people to sort of swallow it. But, like, you don't need to know exactly how he got there. He did. He used to be Super Special Forces, whatever you want to call it. Super James Bond assassin guys.
It doesn't jibe with the rest of the world. John Wick doesn't live in the real universe. They live in the world where, like, they have a hotel for assassins and they call a truce when they get there. Like, it's a stylized kind of thing, whereas this one is supposed to be the real world.
Yeah.
In, you know, nondescript America, nondescript city that happens to have Russian gangsters in it. And all of that stuff falls away slowly. Right. So, like, his hints of him being a super guy, like, show up slowly. And then when he has that fight on the bus, he gets his ass kicked. So it's like, okay, is he actually not good at this or what? And it's not until later when he's blowing up everything and he's like ultra confident. I'm like, where did this come from? How come he wasn't doing this on the bus or in the beginning of the movie? Like, he can't get his trash out on time. Like, it's like they just threw the ideas in there without thinking them through.
I guess. I mean, but I think that's sort of the point, is that he's bad at taking the trash out. And he's good at murdering Russians. These are not transferable skills. Like, there's not things that make you, if you're good at one thing, it doesn't make you as good at something else. And I think that's ultimately the point, is that, like, you know, if you being good at this particular thing, which is weird and dangerous, doesn't make you good at other stuff. And it may make it much harder for you to adapt to other stuff. So, I mean, I think that, I mean, the big difference in just in logistics of the fight on the bus versus him in the rest of the movie is in the rest of the movie, he has guns and the upper hand. In the bus, he's just walking into a small space filled with metal and glass, and he tries to beat up six guys. And in the other scenes in the movie where he's killing everybody, it's because he has guns or it's in his own house and he can kind of sneak around and, you know, be clever about moving. And, you know, he's certainly better at it when, like, they all come to kill him in the home. So, like, yeah, that all of a sudden he sort of levels up, basically, without really doing anything to earn that. But the idea is that he's had those skills all along. It's just been kind of rusty. It's kind of how I took it.
I guess so. And then I thought it was odd that, I mean, even in John Wick, they comment on the fact that the guy kills his dog and he's decided to murder 7,000 people because of that. And they're like, okay, well, you killed the one living thing that he still cared about. And we know he's basically the angel of death, so that's bad for us. But in this one, he has a whole family. And so, like, he just makes that decision, like, I'm going to put my family in my safe house in the basement and murder all these people who are shooting up my house. And, like, I guess I'll just deal with the consequences later. Like, the family's treated like such an object.
Yeah.
You know? They don't have any of those moments where that's like, hey, I'm actually a murdering psycho, you know? And she's like, oh, okay. I mean, the movie could have been 4 hours, but can't they get a wink and a nod? Like, hey, I didn't know you could do this. And now I'm happy to still be with you. Cause I mean, their marriage is on the rocks at that point. You know, he's like, we never have sex anymore. We never go out.
Yeah. Like,
now that you know, I can shoot people in the face, you're into me again.
Well, actually, that's not what I got. I actually got out of it that she knew, because she's patching him up. And so, and there's the scene of them at the end looking at, the, you know, for the new house, where in the middle of talking to the realtor, he gets a phone call and they kind of have that knowing look, like, we should make sure that there's a good basement in this house for the next time we have to build our own little bomb sheltery type safe house, the safe room. Like, the family is the weakest part of the movie by far. Of all the things to say, like, this is underdeveloped and kind of like empty. It's that. Even the stuff with his dad and his black brother, you know, shooting up the Home Alone the machine shop at the end, while over the top and kind of goofy, it wasn't wildly confusing or inconsistent with what was going on. But the thing about his family is that, like, you know, his son really doesn't respect him whatsoever, to the point where it's kind of weird and absurd. His daughter is the opposite of that entirely. And his wife is sort of barely a character. She's not even there. The only time they have a conversation is when she patches him up from getting stabbed a few times and talks to him for a minute like this is something they used to do a lot. And then he points out that, yeah, we haven't had a good relationship for the last X many years, and we need to fix that. Like, it's weird. It's not very developed at all. Like, they hint at things, but you need to do more than that in that case.
Yeah, and it's a little too much hinting.
Yeah, there's no, she has no character. She's both surprised and not at the same time. When she gets shoved into the basement and looks terrified, she's surprised. When she's patching up his wounds, she's not surprised. So which is it? You know.
Yeah. Well, same with the dad. Like, I guess the dad was a secret. The dad was in the FBI at one point too.
Yeah.
But beyond that, I was like.
Yeah, it was vague.
Why is he here?
Yeah. So like the world building. I think you're right. They were really obsessed with the whole idea of a schlubby kind of guy who lives in our consciousness and pop culture as, you know, a non-threatening entity taking on the Russian mob. And I've had ideas for stories like this for years because they're interesting. You find people to play against type, which I've always find fun. And like, you know, there was a weird movie with Matt Damon. What was it? Suburbicon or something like that. And it was a terribly marketed film. It didn't do very well. And it looked like, you know, people getting in over their heads with gangsters, like normal folks getting in over their heads with gangsters and somehow prevailing. But it ended up being really, really about racism because that's what Matt Damon wants to make films about. Yeah, it was weird.
Mm.
Yeah, but you know, I like the concept of the, you know, of the normal everyday Joe Sweatsock who finds himself in a situation for which he would seemingly be ill prepared, and yet finding a way to persevere throughout. And in this case, they get away with that by making him a super soldier. And it's actually the least interesting thing you could do, despite the fact that I thought the movie was fun. You know, and I certainly enjoyed some of the clever things. You know, like I like the scene where he's talking to the guy at the end where he's sitting there with the what kind of a mine is that?
It's like Claymore. You
know. Yeah, thank you. Claymore mine. Which I always love the label on, like, this side towards enemy kind of thing, like whatever it says. It's just, which is really what they say. It's not like they make that up. That's just, you know, it's not funny. It's real. So that those scenes were, you know, that was kind of fun. And he goes and he burns all their money. And, like, it's just, at that point, the absurdity of the situation catches up with itself and they just kind of ride it out to the end. That's fine. But, you know, that's the easy way to do it. The harder way to do it is to do all the things that you are essentially missing, which is to say, why is he miserable? And what explains his abilities to do these things, to be superhuman besides, you know, intensive military training? Can you write a story like that? And I don't know. I've thought about it. I've never gotten around to it. But that, like, it's something about that to me is appealing, just because, like, you know, well, things that I mentioned before about criticisms of this sort of lifestyle and how it's sort of passé and old fashioned, and you know, it gets a lot of flack from people who make movies. But if you know, if you can find a way to write that, and it, you know, without making it a, you know, a horror film or a tragedy, I think that that would be an interesting movie, more so than this one. Although, again, I like this movie.
And I just, I mean, first I thought it was a comedy, and it wasn't, and that's fine. And then it's set up again, like it's going to be against type. Like, I don't think he's playing against type, because he's not, he doesn't like learn to be a super soldier. It's not like he gains confidence or gains skills. You know, there's no like learning here. He's basically the same guy he always is, you know. If it had been like that, where he would, like, you know, this kind of character would be like the side character in an action movie. Like, you'd put him next to The Rock and he'd be the comic relief. Like, oh, how to handle a gun, you know? And then it turned out it wasn't that either. He was already proficient in that stuff. And I mean, he was in good shape for Bob Odenkirk shape. He's not The Rock, but
he was much thinner. You could see it in his face. He didn't carry that, like, you know, baby fat on his face.
Yeah. Like, he definitely was in shape for this. Okay, so like you're just watching him, you're just waiting for the reveal, and I don't know. It was hard to connect with him, because I was constantly being thrown off as to what it was I'm supposed to be. What am I supposed to be getting behind? I can't relate to it. Like, you can't relate to him because he's so closed off, and then you definitely can't relate to him because it turns out that he's not normal like other characters. I mean, he's beyond anything. To the point where he like strikes fear in the heart of everyone. So I was like, okay, then. And then like his family has no connection. And like even his best friend that he talks to on the radio, like the transistor thing, you don't know who that is. It's just some friend he has in hiding until he shows up at the end. So it's not like you can even hang out with that guy.
Isn't that his
way
brother?
Into the movie here. What?
Isn't that his brother? I thought that was like his
the black
like,
guy?
Yeah.
I don't think so. If I know my genetics, no.
No, I thought that was the point. Like, he was supposed to be...
I thought it was just like a friend from the old
yeah,
days.
No, that's his brother.
But he's black.
Look, I understand the man is black, but he has the same last name in the credits. RZA, or I'm sure I'm saying that like an idiot.
Yeah, he's a rapper or something.
Yeah. Like, Harry Mansell is his character's name. And Bob Odenkirk plays Hutch, and then, you know, Christopher Lloyd is David, and yeah, it's all... So like, it's like his half-brother or whatever. And if it got mentioned, it was mentioned very quickly.
I didn't catch it.
Yeah. But I don't know, I caught it quickly, and then but I didn't get the explanation. It didn't stick in my head. Mm. But, I mean, yeah, I mean, he's playing against type, really, in terms of our perspective on who Bob Odenkirk is.
Right, and just in how he looks.
He's not playing against type in terms of the movie. Yeah, it's clear from the beginning. There is no reveal as to, you know, like, it's... Well, there is. It's just sort of slow and then, you know, total. Like, you know, okay, something's not right. Oh, it's because he's an insane super assassin kind of thing. Like, it's not... Yeah, there's no learning. There's just, you know, they're sort of substituting learning for a reveal.
Right.
Or
well,
a reveal for learning.
Where's the lesson? Where's the moral of this? Even John Wick had one.
I think they were trying to say that this wasn't really going to work. Like, he can't not be this person. He's going to, something eventually will bubble up from within, you know.
Because, I mean, that's the John Wick lesson, where it's like, without his wife, and I guess the dog is the extension of the wife, you know, without that anchor, he slips back into mass murdering crazy person.
Yeah.
Someone
that's
to be afraid
of. Essentially
what
this is, but, it's the same exact thing, basically, except that there's no powerful moment, such as the death of the wife, and an even more powerful moment than that, the death of a dog. I mean, for God's sakes, you know, there's actually a website, I think, you know, like doesthedogdie.com. Like, people have a hard time watching movies that involve dogs dying, and it, you know. it'll tell you before you go see it. No, the, like, no dogs die. And I'm going to Google that now. Like, doesthedoglive.com. It does the dog die. If you Google it. Yeah, doesthedogdie.com. And yeah, John Wick. Yes, his dog dies at the beginning of the story. Crowdsourced emotional spoilers for movies, TVs, books, and more. This is great. Somebody really worked hard on that. But anyway, but there is no moment like that for him. It's just assumed that the situation, you know, yeah, okay, so the breaking and entering thing, and it's hard to figure out what is the trigger exactly. I guess it's the daughter and the kid who and the son who can't stand him, but like,
right, I mean, like,
that's what pushes you over the edge finally. Like,
yeah, she loses some trinket that she's going to forget about 5 minutes later.
Yeah.
I mean, after having like his brother-in-law tell him he's an idiot and his wife stare at him with pity and his son with contempt, I'm like, this is the thing, you know? And then like, he still has to get it out. Like, he was going to attack those people and he was like, ah, I have too much of a conscience for this. You know, they're just a bunch of hoodlums. And then when like, he's on the bus, he's like, now I'm going to get it out. I'm like, why? I mean, it just happened to be lucky that they were there, that he could beat them up.
Yeah.
Who would he have beaten up in the meantime?
Yeah, so the inciting incident isn't one incident. It's really 1,000 incidents. And they try and do that in like the opening, you know, montages with the running and the chin-ups and the missing of the garbage truck kind of thing. And like, you know, the idea is that he's so beaten down by suburban life that the straw that breaks the camel's back is the home invasion. And, you know, you're right. Like, even during it, he realizes, like, I don't have to attack these people. Like, I could kill them both. But like, he's able to read the situation and realize, like, just get out of the house. But the son doesn't know that. And he then accuses him of being a coward. And, he, you know, like, that's the second to last straw, and then the last one is the kid's toy, or the kid's bracelet, or whatever it was, and that's, you know, and it's just not as powerful as a dead dog.
Yeah, I didn't have any fun watching it.
Oh, I had a lot of fun. Come on,
I was sort of like waiting for it to end. I was like,
I mean, there was no surprises. There's like, you know how it's going to end. You know, like, once it got goofier and goofier, like, I was waiting for Christopher Lloyd to die, and like, that would be, you know, that would have been one more thing to push him even further. But then that got real kind of hilarious, and
yeah, once he blows them away in the old folks' home with a shotgun, I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah. So like, I don't know. It wasn't as deep a film as John Wick, he said, ironically.
No, it wasn't.
Yeah, I mean, John Wick is certainly it's just a much stronger story, and its world development is more thorough and creative, and I think better acted in general. Like, this, the, you know, the people who populate the world of John Wick are fantastic. Between what's his face from Deadwood, I can't think of his name now.
Ian McShane.
Ian McShane and Lance Reddick from The Wire, who's in it. He plays like the tailor, and and Common, who's boring as hell, but like, you know, it's, these are not that.
God bless him. He still keeps getting work.
He really does. You know, he's very tall. Yeah, they make that universe a lot more interesting to have to spend time in. And this doesn't have it. This is just Vancouver. In the rain.
Is it?
And,
I mean, it's supposed to be.
Actually, but it's, whenever you're looking for a city that you don't, like, that's cheap and nondescript, it's almost always Vancouver. Because Canada is very cheap to shoot in.
Yeah, I figured it was supposed to be, like, generic American city.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That used to be cities in Australia for a while, too. Big budget films would shoot in Australia, but it's just, no one's going to Australia to shoot anything these days.
No.
So, but I don't know. I still thought this was fun. You know, it I mean, look, if we're talking about, you know, Godzilla versus Kong and Mortal Kombat, you know, this is Casablanca compared to Mortal Kombat, for crying out loud. I mean, it's just, well, yeah. I mean, there's like plot holes in it, either. But like, it's not like stupid or confusing. It's, you know, it's fun. It's action packed. It certainly gets goofier at the end. The tone of the first half of the film is different than the tone of the second half of the film. But you know, it was a hoot. You know, like it was enjoyable, I feel.
All right. Well, I didn't like it much. At least
I would recommend it if you like. Yeah, well, and it's short too. Like, that's the thing. Like, the story is told efficiently. There's not a lot of wasted dialogue, and it doesn't go on too long. Like, you there's no surprises as to how it's going to end. Like, you know that he's going to live, and they're all going to die. And you know, some things were clever. I like the scene in the back of he gets put in the trunk of the car, and he uses the fire extinguisher to, you know, that caused an accident. Like, these things were kind of clever. They were a little bit unique, you know. That didn't last. It just became shoot them all in the face as fast as possible.
Oh yeah,
but you know, it could have been worse. It really could have been a little worse. So yeah.
Yeah, all right. On to the next one.
Well, if you out there in Radio Land got to see Nobody and want to agree with either me or with Phil, you should let us know on Twitter or Instagram. We are at @3drinksinpod on both. You can find us on Facebook, and you can email us at 3drinksinpodcast@gmail.com. Don't forget to go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts to subscribe and make sure that your friends know, leave reviews or at least ratings. And don't forget to check out the merch store at tpublic.com. Everything from onesies to face masks to t-shirts to, I think, cell phone cases. There's all kinds of stuff on there. Go check those things out. Anything else?
Yeah, that's it.
All right. As always, please drink responsibly, and we'll talk to you all next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye.